You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, what do the latest astronomy results from the International Space Station and the Planck satellite tell us about antimatter, dark matter, the universe, and everything?
There are a lot of things that we might have liked to do, like, you know, spin the universe, that are going to be a lot harder because of this Planck data.
Astronomer Brian Schmidt recalls his role in the Nobel-winning discovery of dark energy.
I could see what was going on just by eye. I immediately said, oh boy, what have we done wrong?
We provide tips for this year's FQXI essay contest on It From Bit or Bit From It.
And we take a look at the latest in computing with DNA.
And you can develop many, many, many parallel reactions. So a single test tube can have, you know, a large amount of computation going on in parallel, even though each computation itself may be somewhat slow.
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster. Welcome to the FQXI podcast. Later, we promise to tell you more about this year's FQXI essay contest, about the physics of information, including hints on what the judges are looking for.
But before we get to the information end of the podcast, we're delving into astronomy. And what better place to start than at the beginning? Zia, what do you think the Big Bang sounded like?
Kind of like a bang that was really, really big. Clues in the name?
No, it's more like this.
At the beginning it sounds like it's about to go into the theme tune of Doctor Who, then it sounds a bit like a plane taking off, and sometimes it sounds a bit like a bee or a drill. Not quite what I was expecting.
That was actually an audio rendering of new measurements of the cosmic microwave background radiation, the afterglow of the Big Bang. That sound clip was produced by John G. Kramer, a professor of physics at the University of Washington, who used Mathematica to turn the data recently released by the European Space Agency's Planck satellite team into sound. You can find a link to more of his sound files and his explanation for how he produced them on the podcast page www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
The Planck satellite has been measuring hot and cold spots in the cosmic microwave background radiation, and in March, they announced their first cosmological findings. Seems there's been a shift in what we thought was the age of the universe and in its makeup. So we now have slightly different values for the amount of dark matter in the universe. That's the invisible matter that can't be seen directly through telescopes, but which exerts a gravitational pull on surrounding objects. And astronomers have also revised their estimates for the amount of dark energy in the universe. That's the mysterious stuff that seems to be pushing the cosmos apart and causing the expansion of the universe to accelerate.
You've probably read the headlines about the Planck release, and that's not the only dark matter announcement to have hit the news recently. A couple of weeks ago, astronomers announced the detection of certain antimatter particles by the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer on the International Space Station. That have been widely reported as finding the best hints of dark matter.
But don't get too excited yet, Brendan. Some of those announcements may have been slightly exaggerated, shall we say? So to mark this exciting month of cosmic results, we invited Katie Mack, an astrophysicist at the University of Melbourne in Australia, to put things into perspective for us. I spoke to her earlier and chatted through what these results really mean, and what we should be getting excited about. Before we turned to Planck, Katie began by explaining exactly what the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer detector was looking for, and what it found.
So AMS is a cosmic ray detector, and it's a little box that hangs off the side of the International Space Station, and it's looking for cosmic rays. So it's looking for electrons, protons, and the antiparticles of those, positrons for the electrons, and antiprotons, the antimatter version of the proton. And what it's able to do is it's able to detect the cosmic rays, and it's able to figure out what their energies are. And specifically, one of the aims of AMS is to look for antimatter that might come from dark matter annihilation.
So what did they find, actually? What was their announcement?
So their announcement was that they found more positrons than usual astrophysical models would suggest there should be. This same excess has been seen by two other probes, one called Pamela, which is an Italian satellite, and one called Fermi, which is a gamma ray satellite.
There have been a lot of headlines around about how these are the best hints we've had of dark matter so far. How is this result connected to dark matter? And would you say that, you know, this is the best signature of dark matter that we've seen?
No, it's definitely not. There have been a lot of headlines that have said that, you know, this is our best clue about dark matter. We've known about dark matter for a long time. We've had evidence of dark matter since, I think, the 1930s. And that evidence has just been getting more certain over the years. We know from looking at the way that galaxies are moving, we know from looking at the cosmic microwave background, gravitational lensing, collisions of clusters of galaxies, there are so many lines of evidence for the fact that dark matter exists. What we haven't seen, and what people are suggesting that AMS might be giving us some insight into, is we haven't seen particle physics interactions of dark matter, which is to say, we think dark matter is made of some kind of particle. We think that this particle probably has some kind of interaction with itself or with other particles. And we haven't seen any kind of interaction that we've been sure about. And specifically, the AMS detector, what it saw, this excess of positrons, is the kind of thing that you might expect from certain kinds of models of dark matter, where the dark matter particle is its own antiparticle. So anytime a dark matter particle hits another dark matter particle, if it's a very direct collision, then there would be an annihilation. And that annihilation would produce cascade of particles, and some of those particles would be electron-positron pairs. And then that would raise the positron fraction, and you'd see some sign of it in something like one of these cosmic ray detectors. But that's not something that I would call evidence, in the sense that certain models of dark matter annihilation can produce a positron excess that looks kind of like what AMS saw, but other things can mimic the signal you're looking for. And one of the biggest ones, and the most important one for this purpose, is pulsars. So pulsars are very compact, sort of dead stars. They're neutron stars. They're made of basically super compact clumps of neutrons, and they spin very fast. They have this very strong magnetic field, and that magnetic field, it accelerates particles. And in that particle acceleration, it can produce electron-positron pairs. You know, it's well within the realm of possibility that the signal has nothing to do with dark matter at all, and it's just pulsar emission. So one of the other things that was discussed as being a sign that this signal might be dark matter was that it appeared from the data that the signal was coming from all directions equally. And that's actually kind of a subtle issue. Dark matter is not uniformly distributed throughout the universe. Dark matter is clustered where other kinds of matter are. In our galaxy, the dark matter is distributed throughout the galaxy. It's kind of a spherical blob in which our galaxy is sitting, and it's much more dense at the center. So, you know, really you wouldn't expect that dark matter annihilation wouldn't be happening equally in all directions. It would be happening more at the galactic center. But it turns out that the particles that AMS can detect can't propagate that far. So we wouldn't actually be able to see dark matter annihilation happening in the galactic center with something like AMS. But what we can probe is the dark matter that's more nearby. And if we can only detect the annihilation products from annihilation nearby, then you do expect that it should be coming roughly the same amount from each direction. But even that's a slightly more subtle point, because there are magnetic fields in the galaxy. And there's a very complicated magnetic field in our galaxy with little pockets going one way and going another way. So even if we had just one pulsar producing all of the signal that AMS is seeing, it would look like it was coming basically from all directions, because the particles, as they were coming toward us, would be flipped around and moved around in big arcs and redirected in such a way that signal would still look basically isotropic. And so the measure of how different it is in every direction that you're looking, the AMS experiment can measure, is not really sufficient to tell the difference between the signal coming from a few pulsars at specific points in the sky or coming from dark matter that's distributed kind of all around us, because the magnetic fields make that a really difficult thing to determine, and just fundamentally, the particles can't travel in straight lines.
So then going forwards, you know, there's been this excitement about dark matter, but as you say, there are other explanations, possibly more plausible explanations. How will astrophysicists now be trying to differentiate between these possibilities? Is it a case of running new experiments? Is it a case of getting more refined measurements from this particular detector, or running different experiments, or improving astrophysical models? Where do you go from here?
Well, all of the above, really. So one of the things that the AMS collaboration has suggested is that if they can measure the positron excess to somewhat higher energies, they might be able to see this rising signal turn around and drop off. And that kind of drop at high energies might be what you would expect for if this were dark matter annihilation, because basically the dark matter annihilation would not be able to produce particles that are a lot more energetic than the dark matter particles themselves were. So there should be some energy at which it won't be able to produce any higher energy positrons, and then you'd have sort of a drop-off of the signal at that point. However, that really wouldn't be definitive in any way, because not all models of dark matter annihilation have a very sharp drop-off. There are some that have a very smooth turnover in the signal, and also some pulsar models also have a sharp drop-off. It depends on various parameters of the model. So we really need other kinds of measurements. We need to look at gamma ray signals, we need to look at radio signals, we need to look at other methods of detection for dark matter. There are direct detection experiments where they have underground labs waiting for dark matter particles to run into their machines. The LHC might be able to produce dark matter particles, and so, you know, we need to continue those efforts. And then there are a number of other more indirect things where we can look for signals of dark matter annihilation in the early universe, or look for the effects of dark matter annihilation on the way that stars and galaxies are forming in the early universe, all kinds of things like that.
Okay, right. Now, I guess that just highlights how difficult it is to analyze the kind of data that comes out, because many things can mimic the same signal. So thank you very much there. And of course, there was another big result that came out in March. The scientists behind the Planck satellite released some data, and they were looking at the cosmic microwave background radiation, the sort of the relic radiation from the Big Bang. So first of all, Katie, let me ask you, we've seen maps of the cosmic microwave background before. The WMAP satellite, for instance, gave us, you know, fairly recently a very, very nice picture of the cosmic microwave background, and we learnt a lot from that. We sort of seem to see evidence that the universe is made up of a certain amount of dark energy and dark matter. It seemed to also corroborate some popular models of what happened in the early universe, in particular, this model of inflation that says that, you know, very soon after the Big Bang, the universe rapidly inflated at kind of an exponential rate. So why did we sort of need more measurements? What exactly was Planck trying to probe?
The big advantages that Planck has, one is that it's a much higher resolution, so it can see smaller structures on the sky. And the other is it has many more frequencies than WMAP. So for instance, the galaxy puts out a lot of radiation at the kind of frequencies that these satellites are looking at. And if you have more frequencies, you can more easily subtract out the galaxy's contamination. WMAP had 5 frequencies, Planck has 9.
And so let's talk about that better picture now. So what does it tell us about, I guess, the ingredients in the universe?
Planck gave us a slightly different recipe for the components of the universe. So before the Planck satellite, the percentages, it used to be something like 73% dark energy, 23% dark matter, and 4.5% ordinary matter. Now it's more like 68% dark energy, 27% dark matter, and 5% ordinary matter. So, you know, that's kind of nice, because dark energy is the part we understand least. As somebody who studies primarily dark matter, it's nice to see there's a little bit more of that. So that changed a little bit. The age of the universe, Planck suggested a slightly higher estimate for the age of the universe. We used to think about 13.7 billion years. Now we're thinking maybe 13.8. So there are a couple of things like that. We've also gotten much better measurements of the non-Gaussianity. So the non-Gaussianity parameter sort of measures how skewed the distribution of the hot and cold spots are. And that's actually really important for models of inflation. So trying to understand the very first moments of the universe when it was expanding exponentially, and getting a better idea of what kinds of models of inflation are still viable. And the non-Gaussianity puts some pretty strong limits on those. In the case of Planck, they're all basically suggesting a pretty simple set of inflationary models. I've heard, you know, people have said that they're quite disappointed because the Planck seems to be ruling out a lot of really interesting stuff. And somebody has been calling it the maximally boring universe. and not everything that Planck found was, you know, boring, I would say. I think that it found some really amazing things. Like, one of the things that I think is the coolest thing that they've done is they made a map of all of the dark matter in the universe. I mean, it's a very low resolution map. It's really noisy. Just, you know, a few blobs here and there. But you can actually get sort of a picture of where all that matter is. And I think that's really amazing. One of the things that they were able to do, which is also amazing, is they were able to weigh some of the earliest galaxies in the universe by doing a correlation between the gravitational lensing effect they saw in the map and the infrared background light. So there's sort of background light in all directions at infrared wavelengths, and Planck was able to measure that and correlate that with the gravitational lensing. And the infrared background light, we think, comes from the first star-forming galaxies in the universe, very early star-forming galaxies. And so they were able to make a measurement of the mass of those very early galaxies. I mean, it's a huge data set with all sorts of information in it, and it's just a goldmine for understanding a lot of things that are happening in the early universe.
You know, over the years, I've spoken to a lot of cosmologists and a lot of astrophysicists about, for instance, the WMAP data. And they were often sort of picking out very intriguing anomalies or strange or inexplicable features. There were things like giant cold spots or, you know, something called the axis of evil, which was like a special direction in the cosmic microwave background. And, you know, whenever I spoke to them, they sort of say, oh, you know, we need more data. We need, you know, the Planck satellite will tell us whether these features are really there or not.
So they haven't disappeared. So there's a set of things called the WMAP anomalies that are weird things in the data that basically Planck confirms those are really in the data. And it's not just an instrumental effect because they've now been seen in both of these instruments. And we don't really know what they mean. So you mentioned there's a cold spot. So if you just look at the Planck map, it's an oval-shaped map of the sky, and you have sort of blobs of red and blobs of blue. There's kind of a big blob of blue that sort of jumps out at you, and that's the cold spot. That's an anomalously cold region of the sky. It's colder than it should be, according to our models. We don't know why. So that's one thing that people have proposed certain very speculative exotic models to explain why that might be the case. There's an asymmetry between two halves of the sky. So one half of the sky has more variation, basically, than the other half. So it has hotter hot spots and colder cold spots. And the other half has sort of more moderate hot and cold spots. And we don't know why there should be a difference between one half of the sky and the other in terms of how much variation there is. There's also alignment. You mentioned it's called the axis of evil. If you take the map and you decompose it into spherical harmonics, which is kind of just a way of analyzing data on a sphere, there's an alignment between some of the modes that we don't expect to see. And those alignments suggest a preferred direction. And it happens that those alignments work out that the preferred direction is sort of perpendicular to the ecliptic plane, where the ecliptic plane is the plane of the solar system. And we really don't see any reason why that should be the case. It's not clear if these are all just coincidences or if they're telling us something, you know, deep and meaningful about the universe. And this is something that we have to figure out.
So, you know, you mentioned some of these kind of exotic and speculative ideas that people have been having. And of course, I guess the most famous ones are, you know, cosmologists suggesting that maybe these could be signs of collisions with other universes in the multiverse. And, you know, I've spoken to other cosmologists wondering whether the universe itself is rotating or just, you know, other weird objects existing in the universe. So I guess from this, what you're saying is this is good news for them. You know, it hasn't ruled anything out at this point?
Well, you know, I mean, even though some of these models are extremely speculative, you know, they generally can be ruled out. And we have ruled out some of those weird models. So like you mentioned rotational, you know, universe rotating. There are models of rotations in the universe where the whole universe is rotating in some way. And Planck was able to put really strong limits on that and rule out a lot of those models. Then the other thing you mentioned was collisions with other universes. There have been suggestions that if you have a collision between basically two universes, you can get patterns on the sky and you get sort of these big circles. And WMAP combed through the data to look for those kinds of signs of collisions and didn't see any of them. And so we can rule out some of those kinds of more exotic models. Yeah, there are cool, weird signals that we might have to come up with even weirder models to explain. But we don't really have free rein because this data is very precise. And as theorists, we have to work within those constraints. And there are a lot of things that we might have liked to do, like, you know, spin the universe, that are going to be a lot harder because of this Planck data. So it's kind of interesting. We can't just go on total flights of fancy.
Putting sort of those more exotic models aside, for astrophysicists like you, what are you looking forward to now? What will you be sort of looking for in that data or hoping for in future releases?
The main thing that Planck has not yet told us that we really want to know is about the polarization. So Planck measures not just the temperature on the sky, but the polarization of the light coming from these different places in the cosmic microwave background. And that polarization data has some really important implications for the early universe and for various kinds of models that we might want to be testing. So they're going to put out the polarization data sometime soon, and that will actually tell us a lot, and that'll be really exciting. So one of the things the polarization data will be able to tell us about is gravitational waves from the early universe, basically. And so we'll be able to get some new information about inflation from that polarization data. So we're all kind of, you know, eagerly awaiting that.
Thank you to Katie Mack for taking Zia through those results. On our podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll find a link to a blog post that Katie wrote for Physics Focus about the results, along with links to related articles about the cosmic microwave background. You can also follow Katie on Twitter at AstroKatie. That's AstroKatie. And of course, you can follow us at FQXI if you don't already. So Planck says that there's a tiny bit less dark energy in the universe than we thought, but it still makes up the biggest component of the universe's energy budget. And it's still a big mystery, as physicists struggle to find out what it is and how it powers the universe outwards against the inward pull of gravity. Measurements of the cosmic microwave background helped to prove that this strange effect is real, but it was first stumbled on many years earlier by two independent teams of astronomers looking at something quite different: the distance to faraway supernova. It was such a groundbreaking discovery that in 2011, the Nobel Prize in Physics was shared between Brian Schmidt at the Australian National University and Adam Riess at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore on one team, and Saul Perlmutter at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, who led the other team. Zia, you recently interviewed each of them for an article in Discover magazine, right?
Yes, that's right. My article about their amazing discovery and what astronomers are doing today to try and pin down its cause is in the May issue of Discover magazine. What was really exciting for me talking to them was to get a sense of how they got their first inkling that they had made, well, either a huge discovery or a gigantic and embarrassing mistake. And once they realised they were onto something big, each group raced to publish their findings before their competitor. Last year, while preparing for the article, I was lucky enough to meet up with Schmidt, who was visiting London because he was being inducted as a Fellow of the Royal Society. He talked me through the discovery, which had its roots in his childhood interest in astronomy.
So I grew up with parents who I slightly surprised by coming on the scene. They were undergraduates, so they were 19 and 20 when they had me. And my father was studying to be a biologist. So I grew up with the science as he did it. And so I was immersed in science, albeit biology, at a very young age. Astronomy was not something I thought too much about until I was, I think, in second or third grade. There was a comet, Comet West, that came out, and I suddenly saw that the night sky could change and be interesting, and so that, you know, piqued an interest in astronomy. My parents bought me a cheap little telescope. I remember seeing Jupiter, and so astronomy was always something I was interested in there on after.
In 2011, Schmidt was awarded a share of the Nobel Prize in Physics for the discovery that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. He shared the prize with team member Adam Riess, now at Johns Hopkins University, and with Saul Perlmutter of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, who led a rival study that made the same startling finding. The techniques the teams used built on the groundbreaking work of astronomers Edwin Hubble and Vesto Melvin Slipher in the first half of the 20th century, which first revealed that the universe is expanding.
In 1916, Vesto Melvin Slipher went through and he measured the redshift of galaxies. Redshift is how much their light has been shifted to the red or to the blue by what he would describe at the time by their velocity, by the Doppler shift. And in 1916, Slipher realized that almost all the galaxies, which he didn't even know what galaxies were at the time, were moving, their spectra was shifted to the red. So it was like every object was moving away from us. Edwin Hubble went out and decided to measure the distances to these galaxies. And in astronomy, it's very hard to measure distances because you just can't lay down rulers between us and the nearest galaxy. And so what he decided to do was to look at how bright stars were in the nearest galaxy. Now, since the time of Newton, we've known that the further away an object is, the fainter it appears. And so Hubble said, well, let's just assume all the stars in all galaxies, the brightest ones, are the same brightness. And that's probably a reasonable approximation. It is. It's good to factors of 10. So he was able to look at how bright stars were in all these galaxies, and what he found was the fainter the stars were in the galaxy, that is, the further away the galaxy was, the more the galaxy was redshifted. And that is what he announced in 1929 meant that the universe was expanding. Because the further away something is, the faster it's moving. And if I take, for example, a balloon and I put little stars on it and I blow the balloon up, as I blow the balloon up, every star moves away from every other star. The further away the stars are, the faster the stars move apart as I blow that balloon out. So it's just like what Hubble was seeing in our own galaxy.
Neither team expected to find that the universe's expansion was speeding up. Einstein's general theory of relativity predicted that the expansion should actually be slowing down as matter is pulled back inwards by the gravity of other matter in the cosmos. Both teams hoped that by measuring the rate of this predicted deceleration, they would learn other exciting facts about the fate of the universe.
And general relativity makes very specific predictions about the universe's past. That is, the trajectory that the universe takes ultimately depends on what is in the universe, how much, and how it behaves. So back in 1994, when we started our project, life was very simple. The only thing in the universe was stuff like you and me and dark matter, which we're not going to talk about. But it's for gravity's sake, it behaves exactly the same. And there was a one-to-one correspondence. The more stuff there was in the universe, the faster the universe would slow down over time, and there was a critical density of material in the universe where the universe would eventually stop its expansion and then go into reverse. That amount of deceleration was a very interesting number because space is curved, and under a universe that only has the stuff in it, then you can also use how fast the universe is slowing down to tell you the shape of the universe. If you're above this critical density, space wraps around onto itself, and the universe is finite. So it was a huge question to ask. By measuring what the universe was doing back in time, we could figure out if the universe was infinite or finite, and essentially, that's about as big a question as you can imagine. Does the universe last forever, or does it eventually end?
Edwin Hubble's earlier measurements of the expansion of the universe had only been approximate. To make better measurements that could tell us the fate of the universe, astronomers needed to find celestial objects that could act as more accurate yardsticks in the sky. They turned to supernovae, the bright explosions that mark the end of a star's life.
Now, type 1a supernovae are these exploding stars of a white dwarf. So a white dwarf is the end state of our sun after it burns all its hydrogen and helium. This core part of it will collapse down to something about the size of the Earth, but it will have the mass of about 60% of the sun's current mass. So stuff's amazingly dense. A teaspoon weighs a ton. Now that stuff, Chandrasekhar, who ultimately won a Nobel Prize for this and other things, demonstrated that as you add material to a white dwarf, the more material you add, the smaller it gets. So it's kind of funny. It's not like if you add material to the Earth gets bigger. You add a material to a white dwarf, it gets smaller. And that's because the gravity is pushing against the electrons, which push back. As you add more and more gravity, the electrons kind of get squeezed a bit. And at 1.38 times the mass of our sun, the electrons can push back no more. And just before that point, it turns out, the nuclear reactions of the carbon and oxygen in the center of one of these stars ignite like a blasting cap and cause, slowly at first and then running away within a period of a second at the very end, the whole thing explodes as a giant thermonuclear bomb. So these things, you can imagine, are interesting because they're going to explode at a certain very characteristic time in a star's life. These are what we call type 1a supernovae, and when you go out and look at them, they're not exactly the same, but they're quite similar, and by observing how fast they rise in brightness and fall, that tells us how bright they are, how many watts they emit. So by looking at how bright they appear, we can measure their distance. We can measure their distance to about 6%. And so with them, we are able to measure distances back 10 billion years in the past, we can do right now. We can measure their redshifts, that is how much their light had been stretched by the expanding universe. And that enabled us, through Einstein's theory of gravity, to predict the ultimate future of the universe and its past, essentially.
Does that sort of bring us to the actual project that you're famous for?
It's all part of the same story. In 1994, two things happened. A group in Chile, the Kalantololo survey, went through and finished the first part of the really important fundamental basis of type 1a supernovae. They went out and used this class of objects, and they took digital data of a lot of objects for the first time. And when they did that, they showed that these things are not all the same. They differ, that all type 1a supernovae are not the same. You can't use them as a standard candle like we had wanted to, where you say they're all the same brightness. You have to calibrate them. But when you do that calibration, they are really good, much better than we had ever thought they might be. So it turns out they were good to about measuring distances of 6% accuracy. And I was like, wow, they're a lot better than I thought they ever could be.
It was at this point that Adam Riess and Saul Perlmutter, who shared the Nobel Prize with Schmidt, entered the story. Along with other colleagues, together, they realized that type 1a supernovae could be spotted out to far farther distances than previously thought.
The other thing that happened, about a month later, Bob Kirshner, Adam Riess, and Peter Chow, they were out on the telescope, and Saul called up and said, I've got an object for you to look at. They had some time, so they looked at it. And I received an email and the spectrum in the morning with a little note saying, hey, this looks like a type 1a supernova, but at a redshift of 0.42, five times further than we normally see them. And then it emerged as we were discussing this object with them that they had discovered seven of these in the previous 3 months. So in a period of 1 month, I went from thinking doing anything in the distant universe with type 1 supernova was just pointless. They were hard to find and they didn't measure very good distances, to suddenly realizing they measure really good distances and they're not that hard to find. So we, being a royal we, discussed with Saul what to do with this object. We had a spectrum. He had obviously discovered it and doing stuff. And it became very clear to me that he had a fundamental different way of looking at how to do the experiment. And if we wanted to, you know, express ourselves scientifically on how to do this experiment, we were going to have to do our own. So the program was born there in 1994.
The discovery that something was apparently pushing the universe outwards was not immediate for either of the competing teams. After analyzing the first batch of data, Schmidt's team saw slight hints that the expansion of the universe was unexpectedly speeding up, against the predictions of standard physics. But the effect was not big enough to be conclusive. At the same time, however, Saul Perlmutter's group released a paper saying that the universe's expansion was slowing down, as expected by standard physics. The seeming mismatch between the two groups' findings deeply troubled Schmidt.
In 1997, in September, Saul's team put out a paper saying the universe is slowing down quite a lot from their first seven objects. So we were worried, and as a team, we went through huge machinations in September about, are we sure about what we're doing? And it was a bit ugly, but we worked through them in September.
It was Schmidt's colleague, Adam Rees, who saw their team's first definitive signs of dark energy as he began to analyse the second batch of data. Rees had written a computer program that was designed to chew over the data and spit out an estimate for the mass of the universe. His program worked on the assumption that the universe only contains simple things like matter, but no dark energy type component. When he plugged in the data, however, his program told him somewhat nonsensically that the mass of the universe was negative. Rees realised this simply did not make physical sense. Instead, he suspected the only way to get the data to add up correctly would be to include a new energy component, now dubbed dark energy, that pushed the universe outwards. This outward push would have to account for about 70% of the universe's energy budget. The implication was so bizarre that Schmidt, at first, assumed the results must be a mistake.
I could see what was going on just by eye. I immediately said, oh boy, what have we done wrong? So there started quite an intense exchange about going through all of the bits and pieces in the experiment one by one. But on the 8th of January in Australia, Adam and I agreed on every piece of the calculation. We had gone through and literally piece by piece done everything, and our codes got the exact same answer on everything. So at that point I said, okay, I'm ready to sign off on this now.
Eventually, after further analysis, both teams reached the same conclusion and announced their findings. The universe, it seemed, had a new component, dark energy. This strange stuff was pushing the universe outwards and causing the expansion of the universe to accelerate. Now they had to sit back and await the world's response, which was a mixture of excitement and disbelief.
I have to admit, I knew it was going to be a kind of a big deal. I figured people were going to be, just be skeptical. I hadn't really expected it to go completely crazy, but it was heavily covered in the United States with CNN going and, you know, live interview of Adam Rees from Berkeley. And the other part I hadn't predicted was how warmly received it would be from the theorist side of the community. The observers were skeptical. The acceleration had come into vogue many times in the past, always because people had screwed up. So I was worried, but it, as I said, got a much warmer reception than I expected. I expected people to be skeptical. I would have been skeptical. I was skeptical.
So when you did go public with it, you must have had these conflicting emotions about, on the one hand, you're sort of competing with another group, and on the other hand, you don't want to make a fool of yourself by announcing, you know, just something that's just really, really badly wrong.
Well, I have to admit, when I thought the other team was getting that the universe was slowing down very quickly and we were getting it was speeding up, I was concerned because I felt we had done everything correctly and I was willing to swear by our results. But I knew the community, given an absurd result and one they expected, we were going to be in trouble. So I will say, when we saw at the beginning of January that Saul was essentially getting the same answer as us, I felt pretty relieved. It was an intense competition, and I have to admit, I wasn't too worried about getting there first, but I was worried about being there last, if that makes sense.
So at the time, you know, did you foresee how big this was? Maybe that seems silly, because obviously you knew that it was a strange and interesting result, but, you know, it's still with us. People are still just perplexed. Yeah.
So at the time, I knew if it withstood the test of time, it was a big result. That it was a crazy thing, it would be huge if it withstood the test of time. I felt there was a reasonable chance that something, not our fault, something would come up in astrophysics where people say, forgot about this, and it would somehow go away. The other thing that happened in year 2000 is the first cosmic microwave background experiments came along that demonstrated that the universe had flat geometry to within 10%. Now, once that measurement was made, our measurement of the acceleration went from being sort of 4 or 5 standard deviation measurement to like 9. I suddenly, at that point, I remember thinking, wow, we're actually right.
Did you think at that point Nobel Prize?
No, I didn't really expect to get the Nobel Prize. One of these things, you know, people were talking about the Nobel Prize. Well, in science, people talk about the Nobel Prize all the time. And I have met many, many people who thought they were going to win the Nobel Prize who are dead now. And you don't know. My view was the Nobel Prize committee could easily think, we will think about giving this a prize when we understand what it is. In which case, I felt unlikely we would ever get one. And that's fine. On the other hand, I think it's great that they thought this was important enough, just the acceleration itself, even though we don't understand it, that that was an important enough thing to celebrate. So I feel honored, but I certainly didn't expect it. One of the great things I think about the Nobel Prize has been how genuinely excited astronomers have been about the prize, because I think everyone feels it's part theirs. Because it is. It is built up on an entire community. And so that's why a Nobel Prize is so exciting, is it really is a celebration where the world celebrates 100 years of cosmology is effectively what it's celebrating.
That was Brian Schmidt remembering his Nobel-winning discovery of dark energy in the late 1990s. You can read more about that and astronomers' current attempts to home in on what dark energy is through planned space missions in the May issue of Discover magazine. On the podcast page, you'll also find an extended version of that interview in which Schmidt recounts more of the technical details of his experiment.
And don't forget to mention that you can also follow Brian Schmidt on Twitter at CosmicPinot. That's CosmicPinot.
And of course, our Twitter feed at FQXI is the place to get updates about the latest FQXI essay contest. Winning the FQXI essay contest, as we always like to say, is almost as prestigious as winning a Nobel Prize.
Yes, almost.
So, Brendan, tell us more about this year's topic.
This year's topic is It From Bit, or Bit From It. And the idea now is to focus on the physics of information. The past century in fundamental physics, as we say on the website, has shown a steady progression away from thinking about physics at its deepest level as a description of material objects and their interactions, and towards physics as a description of the evolution of information. In fact, recent years have shown an explosion of interest at the nexus of physics and information, driven by the information age in which we live, and more importantly, by developments in quantum information theory and computer science. So we must ask the question, though, is information truly fundamental or not? We ask you, It From Bit, or Bit From It?
Oh, it could be controversial. But I guess, Brendan, what listeners really want to know is, you know, what are the judges looking for? What sort of things could help them do well in this contest?
Well, the winners are actually chosen by a combination of votes from contest entrants, FQXI members, and a final panel of experts. And so, of course, I can't predict what all those people will combine to say. Although what seems to be true in past contests is that the winners usually really are creative and original and fun to read. They like essays that don't just discuss a particular theory, but actually try to answer the question in an honest way and maybe use a particular theory as an example.
And so we should also say that, of course, the essay contest is now open. And so, you know, it's open to both professional physicists and, as always, it's also open to the public. And both those groups are free to vote on the essays when they start to appear on the website. So what's the link for submitting entries?
Good question.
Who knows?
Just go to fqxi.org/community/essay. And there you'll find contest rules. Period.
Right. But then also, the other thing I forgot to ask you is, what is it that judges generally don't like? And also, I guess, the public, what tends to sort of do badly in these contests?
Right. So every year we always get many entries from people who do just what I said, which is to write about a particular theory and not really address the question. And those essays never do well. So that's the thing they don't like. The thing I don't like is when the essays are too long.
Because you have to read them
because
all.
Because we have... yeah. It's starting to sound rather crabby. But and there you have it. What I don't like to see as the contest administrator is essays that are longer than the official page count, because we do have pretty clear rules about that. So if you're going to write an essay, please check out the official rules on our website and make sure that you, well, follow the rules.
And of course, we should mention that, you know, if you want to get an idea of the sort of essays that do well, we have the entries up from many previous essay contests on the website. So you can go along, just go to the general website, www.fqxi.org/community, and just take a look around and you'll be able to see previous entries and of course, a lot of discussion that each of those entries generated on the website.
Yes, we have... years of discussions.
They don't end, do they?
They don't end, but this is actually true. The essay contest each year generates a ton of discussions, which go on long after the contest.
And, of course, our media partner is Scientific American Magazine. And beyond their just being wonderful, they do, on occasion, print some of the winning essays in the magazine. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, such as David Tong's essay from our contest, two contests ago, on questioning the foundations.
And of course, if you have any questions about the essay contest at all, you can email us at mail@fqxi.org. So there we have it. It from bit or bit from it, the physics of information is this year's essay topic. Information, I was about to say, is of course so fundamental, but maybe that should be thrown open to discussion given our essay topic this year. But information is, of course, fundamental to computing, which involves processing information, and in our body, information is stored in DNA within cells.
So it makes sense to bring these two together, which is exactly what Timothy Liu, a synthetic biologist at MIT, and his colleagues are doing. He works on DNA computing, artificially manipulating the function of a cell. The research could have applications in medicine and beyond, for instance, to help detect biological weapons. Reporter Corinne Pikama has been chatting with Liu and his colleague Piero Ciuti about the benefits and the ethics of computing with DNA.
My name is Timothy Liu. I'm an assistant professor at MIT, where I'm appointed in the Department of Biological Engineering, as well as the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science. And generally, my research area focuses on synthetic biology.
The goal of synthetic biologists is to design and build new biological devices and systems, or even redesign existing biological systems in order to enable useful manipulation of these systems. To manipulate biological systems, synthetic biologists are having to tap into the essential building blocks of life, the genetic code, or DNA. DNA, which is short for deoxyribonucleic acid, is nature's storage device for genetic information that makes us what we are. It can be found in the nuclei of all cells in our body. Almost all of the cells in our body have the same DNA, and in spite of all the differences we see between people, we share over 99% of our DNA. Given the vital importance of DNA to life, it is not surprising that synthetic biologists are looking for ways of making and manipulating DNA directly. And some very promising steps have been made towards their goals over the past decade or so. Liu is one of those scientists. Together with his colleagues at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, he's working on DNA computing. This is the ability to artificially manipulate the function of a cell by introducing completely new strands of DNA into the cell and by controlling this DNA to make the cell behave in certain ways. The potential of this research is enormous and could impact dramatically on our lives, from the way in which we treat diseases to the rapid detection of harmful chemicals in our environment. Liu and his colleagues made a breakthrough in this research that was published in Nature Biotechnology in February of this year. I spoke with Liu and with the lead author of the paper, Dr. Piero Ciuti, via Skype. I first asked Liu to explain the two different strands of DNA computing.
If we're talking about DNA computing, there's been a rich history of folks who have been looking at using DNA as a memory storage device and a computational device, primarily in vitro, so outside of cells. On the other hand, there's a complementary field of synthetic biology, where folks are primarily interested in engineering circuits inside of living cells. And so there, DNA is a natural substrate for genetic programming because, you know, as we know, it contains, you know, the blueprint for what cells are instructed to do. And so by basically modifying the DNA inside of a cell, you can instruct the cell to perform different computations inside of living cells.
So researchers like Liu are using principles that come from electronics and applying them to living cells by using DNA. By doing this, they not only expect to gain a better understanding of how biology works, but, and this is perhaps more exciting, they also hope to use these circuits to program the cells to perform new functions. This opens up an entirely novel set of possibilities that are beyond the reach with scientists' current toolkit. Our DNA is made up of four different chemical bases: adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine, or perhaps better known by their initials A, T, G, and C. Our DNA contains about 3 billion of these bases. The information needed to build a human being is determined within the order of these bases. Each base pairs up with another base to form the rungs of the famous double helix ladder. A always pairs with T and G always pairs with C. Liu explains how he uses this knowledge in DNA computing.
Every cell in your body uses ATGC to basically define, you know, what is going on inside of your body, how your body reacts to certain situations, how it grows, etc. We use those same ATGs and Cs, but we put them together in different orders. And by doing that, we basically can create new novel genetic programs that perform specific functions. The thing that we really leverage is a class of proteins known as recombinases. And these recombinases, essentially what they do is that they recognize a specific stretch of DNA, and they can flip the DNA. And so if you imagine a DNA strand with all these ATGs and Cs as kind of a long ticker tape of information, and these recombinase enzymes being able to come in, recognize specific pieces of that DNA, and flip the DNA or cut out a piece of DNA, then that really gives you the power to store and manipulate information in DNA. When, for example, a piece of DNA is in one orientation, we can call that the off state or a zero state in digital logic. And if you flip it upside down, we can call that a one state, for example, or an on state. And so that kind of flipping event gives you the ability to record memory into DNA. And the nice thing about that is that the living cell has all the machinery needed to replicate its own DNA very faithfully. So once you've made this mutation, the cell naturally propagates that to its progeny, and it's stably maintained as memory for a long period of time.
Manipulating the cell's memory in this way is one step in the direction of the ultimate goal to be able to switch DNA inside cells on and off. In their recent Nature Biotechnology paper, Liu and his postdoc Piero Ciuti have come a step closer to this goal. Ciuti explains why this study was so important.
The challenge is to actually be able to sort of combine processing and memory in one single device. So far, it's been done with different kinds of cells, that each one of which has a different gene circuits in it. And what we did is that we took advantage of these recombinase enzymes and developed a more like recombinase-based strategy in order to build all of the functions, all of them in one single cell.
So this was the first time the two, memory and logic, were put together into one cell. Liu explains how logic is actually achieved within the cell.
The way you do that is that you basically, inside of that DNA sequence, that's either zero or one, you can put there specific DNA elements that encode regulatory function. So for example, you can put things called promoters, and what promoters are is they're essentially genetic switches that turn on or turn off expression of a gene. for example, GFP, or green fluorescent protein that we use to visualize these cells. And so you can imagine if you flip that promoter from one orientation to the other, you can turn on or turn off its function. There are several advantages of DNA-based computation. One of it is that you can develop many, many, many parallel reactions. So a single test tube can have, you know, a large amount of computation going on in parallel, even though each computation itself may be somewhat slow. So that kind of parallelized computation may be useful for certain situations. I think the other major advantage, especially in the context of living cells, is that DNA is a natural interface with cellular function. And so inserting these kind of circuits into the cell does not cause immune reactions or some other rejection of the circuit that you're inserting to the cell. Whereas if you try to insert, you know, a silicon chip or other things into a cell, you may have issues associated with that.
This ability to tinker with the way in which cells function, including, of course, our own cells, might worry some people. While sophisticated manipulation of cells that could potentially be used to do harm is still a long way off, Lou and his colleagues in the field of synthetic biology do think about the ethical implications of their research.
There is a concern with genetic engineering of any type. I mean, essentially what we do is advanced versions of genetic engineering. And so there are, you know, governmental and institutional controls on specifically what can be done. And the practitioners in the field are very much aware of the ethics and the safety questions associated with our research. So, you know, at our conferences and at many of our meetings, there are a significant amount of time devoted to, you know, dealing with what are the ethics and the safety that we need to take into account.
So now the researchers are capable of safely manipulating the function of cells by introducing engineered DNA into the cell. This opens up a vast array of possibilities for advancements in fields ranging from medicine to engineering and climate change. For instance, in the development of detectors of biological weapons and the focus on biological alternatives for our ever-increasing fuel consumption. One of the areas of research Lou is particularly excited about is the potential of these circuits in medicine for the detection of cancer.
It gives you much finer control over what you can do inside of a living cell. So let's take an example. Suppose I wanted to engineer a bacteria that's probiotic. So maybe I want to engineer bacteria similar to the bacteria that you eat in your yogurt. That, you know, your yogurt contains live cultures. You're constantly in that bacteria. It can go into the gut and then it comes out. Well, suppose I wanted to turn that bacteria into some sort of sensor. Let's say I wanted the bacteria to perhaps detect, you know, whether there is a signature that you're developing colon cancer. Right. And we like to do this very early on, you know, way before it's detectable by colonoscopy or, you know, bleeding in the stool or whatever. So we could put in a genetic circuit into the bacteria and have it, for example, contain an AND gate. And this AND gate would only turn on if both of its inputs are true. For example, you could say, you know, if I detect, you know, a bleed inside of the colon and I detect some other biomarker of colon cancer, then I flip the switch on. And you know, you can imagine this probiotic bacteria then going through, acting as kind of a non-invasive sensor and coming out the other end with a readout of whether, you know, it detected some sort of signature that's indicative of cancer. That's just a toy example, but it's the kind of stuff that this type of platform, as well as other platforms that folks are developing, may be useful for in the long term.
And Suti gives a very different example of how strategic use of these modified cells can be particularly useful for detecting harmful substances in our air and liquids. He describes how a modified group of cells might be particularly effective in protecting against attacks with biological weapons by sensing when there has been a change in the environment caused by such harmful chemicals.
For example, the police officer, all they have to do if there's any dangerous looking chemical or liquids, all they have to do is just basically put a little drop on the device that contains these cells, and that if there's anything that can be dangerous, they can detect it and give you a product right away. That's one of the longer ideas of applications for it. It still needs some more work on when it comes to how fast we can get the product. But yeah, that's one of the potential applications to it.
So research in synthetic biology could have a far-reaching impact on our lives, from our protection and safety to our health. It has the potential to revolutionize the detection and treatment of currently untreatable diseases, and it may one day defeat our predispositions for diseases that are hardwired into our genetic makeup. and CUT thinks that the applications he and Lu are considering can be achieved in a not too distant future, though it all depends a little on the synthetic biologists themselves.
Considering how fast science has developed in the past 20, 30 years and how fast synthetic biology has moved in the past 15 years, I would truly say I can see this being quite possible in the next 10 to maybe 15 years. The way I see it, there are only two things that synthetic biologists are limited by, and I think it's their creativity and how hard they're willing to work for their projects. So I truly think that actually it's coming really fast.
Thank you to Timothy Liu and Piro Suti for explaining their research to Corinne Picamo there. You'll find links to their research paper in Nature Biotechnology on our podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
That's all we have time for. So thank you again to Katie Mack and Brian Schmidt too. And don't forget to enter the FQXI essay contest.
She's been Zia Morali.
And he's been Brendan Foster.